Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live
and what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW. Thanks for joining us this evening. I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Ethan Elkind.
On tonight's show, we're talking about ways the Bay Area can become more water resilient as water shortages and drought become increasingly common.
Then we'll hear about the fastest growing sport in the U.S., pickleball, from the first female certified pickleball coach in Northern California, Patricia Strozzi.
But first, an update on the Elizabeth Holmes trial.
So Americans love a dramatic jury trial, especially one involving the downfall of a once high-flying defendant. So it's not surprising that the trial of Elizabeth Holmes has captured the country's attention.
Holmes, who dropped out of Stanford at the age of 19 to found the now defunct blood testing company Theranos, became a media darling after she built the company to a $9 billion valuation and turned herself into the world's youngest self-made female billionaire. But she and her company fell hard and fast after questions about Theranos' technology.
On September 8th, just a month after giving birth to a son, Elizabeth Holmes appeared in federal court in San Jose to face charges related to her actions as the founder and CEO of Theranos. Here tonight to give us an update on the trial, we are pleased to be joined by Wall Street Journal legal business reporter Sarah Randazzo. Sarah, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thanks for having me.
So, Sarah, we gave a brief summary in the intro, but can you go into more detail about what Theranos' business was and how it fell apart?
Sure. So, Elizabeth Holmes dropped out of Stanford, as you said, in 2003 and started Theranos. And for several years, they weren't public with what they were working on. And then they finally unveiled themselves several years later and said, we're a blood testing company. We're doing things differently. We don't think you should need large vials of blood drawn every time you have a health condition you want to check. We're going to do it with a finger prick. And so they touted this technology that they said could take a few drops of blood from a finger prick and test for a wide variety of health conditions. They rolled out in Walgreens stores. They had a big partnership, mostly in Arizona pharmacies, and they had patients coming in, getting finger pricks, but also getting regular blood tests drawn. And as the years went on, it came out that when the blood went back to the lab to get tested, they often weren't using their own proprietary technology that they'd been bragging about. And instead, they really just had these commercial machines made by other companies. And in some cases, they were altering those so that it would work with these finger prick samples that they were taking. So really, it started to emerge that their technology wasn't quite up to snuff, wasn't ready for patient consumption, but they were still rolling it out. And then after questions emerged, things started to fall apart. There was an SEC investigation and settlement, and then these criminal charges were kind of the final straw.
And what exactly is Holmes charged with now, and how has she pled?
Yeah, so she faces 10 counts of wire fraud and 2 counts of conspiracy to commit wire fraud. And she was charged alongside the company's former number 2 executive, who was also her boyfriend at a time, named Sonny Balwani. And so the two of them face identical charges. His trial is next. So that's why at this trial, you're only hearing about her being the one facing the charges. And they've both pleaded not guilty. And it's still a question of whether she'll take the stand. But for now, we're in the phase of the case where the prosecution is putting on its evidence.
So now that her trial has begun, how are prosecutors making their case?
Yes, yeah, so we've had 2 weeks of evidence so far. Both sides gave their opening statements, which was their overarching pitch of what they see the case being about. And the prosecution had a theme of, out of time and out of money, Elizabeth Holmes decided to lie. That was a mantra they repeated a few times in the openings. And they're trying to paint for jurors the picture of a company that kept falling short both on money and technology projections, and that they would take shortcuts to get around it. And so we've seen testimony from 3 former employees so far. Each brought kind of different things to the table that have been interesting. The first was a former finance staffer who talked about how the company didn't do any audited financials for many years, which is very rare. Typically, private companies will do those so that investors can have some assurance about their books. They were so secretive, they didn't do those. They also gave rosier projections to investors and to others. That came out during her testimony. The second witness was someone named Erica Chung, who worked at the company for 6 months straight out of college from UC Berkeley. And she's since become pretty outspoken. She's done a TED Talk. She's spoken quite a bit about her experience there. She ultimately went to the SEC to regulators with CMS and reported issues that she found during her time there. So her and another witness were both former lab workers who talked about how they could see firsthand how they didn't think the technology was working. They tried to raise issues. They grew increasingly uncomfortable and eventually quit because of the issues that they saw. So that's some of the testimony we've seen so far.
So how was it that the investors didn't sort of see some concerns or feel some concerns because they weren't publishing their balance sheet or whatever it was that they were supposed to be doing on a yearly basis?
Yeah, it's a good question. And we haven't heard the voices of any investors yet. And I'm really interested for when the trial kind of pivots to that group of witnesses, because that's a group that really hasn't spoken publicly that much. We've heard from former employees quite a bit in recent years. And so I'm really interested to hear from investors of why they didn't push harder. But I think Elizabeth Holmes was very persuasive. She had a very high profile board, people like Henry Kissinger, Jim Mattis, George Shultz. So I think investors saw this board behind her and thought, well, they're supporting her. They've vouched for this. Maybe we don't need to look as deeply as we might otherwise. And so I think they took Elizabeth Holmes and her employees at their word with some of the projections they gave without really digging into what money was coming in the door and what their books actually looked like.
Well, and Sarah, for those of you who watched the documentary on the whole Theranos debacle here, I think it became pretty apparent that her board did not have a very representative sample of scientists and those who are familiar with lab work, number one. So that seemed to be one of the issues around the board and the composition there for investors looking at this. But I'm just curious if you can describe a bit about what we know so far about Holmes's likely defense in this case.
Yeah, so she previewed a few possible options. During the opening statements, her lawyer really took jurors back to the beginning and tried to really humanize her and say, look, here's pictures of her as a 19-year-old starting this company. Here's pictures of her. I think he even showed photos from high school and early college, trying to show she was this wide-eyed entrepreneur who wanted to set out and do something good for the world. And so I think one defense will be she always believed in the company. She thought they were going to make it. She thought the technology would get there. And so, it's only fraud if you're intending. Intent is a huge part of a criminal case. Just because something fell apart and didn't work, that doesn't make it fraud unless someone was really intentionally trying to do it. And so they can try to undercut the intent element of it by saying, hey, she believed in the technology. She thought everything was working and just wasn't quite there yet. So that's one potential line of defense. We've also gotten a preview of a potentially pretty different one, which is that she's going to point the finger at Sonny Balwani, the number two I mentioned, who's also charged. And so there's been some filings that were unsealed that the Wall Street Journal actually really pushed to unseal because they were all basically away from the public eye. And we successfully fought to get those made public. And they show that she could argue she was in an abusive relationship with Mr. Balwani and that weighed on her decision-making, essentially, during the time that they accused her of crimes. And Mr. Balwani's lawyer has really forcefully pushed back against those and said that nothing was abusive, but that will be a pretty interesting dynamic if it does come out. And they didn't explicitly, her lawyers didn't preview that outright to the jurors, so it's still unclear if they'll kind of go there, but they did make a few comments about trusting Mr. Balwani being one of the worst decisions she ever made. So it seems like they'll certainly try to point the finger in some way.
And of course, he's being tried separately, so we'll see what he ends up arguing in his own defense. But do we expect Elizabeth Holmes to take the stand to testify on her own behalf in this case?
It's always hard to know. It's a bit of a guessing game. I think if she brings the defense against Mr. Balwani, it'll be pretty hard to pull that off without taking the stand. It seems like it'd be hard to convey to jurors exactly what was happening in that relationship without her speaking about it directly. So I think that's one gamble her lawyers are going to have to weigh is do we put her on the stand to tell her side of the story on this point and others? But then that, of course, opens her up to potentially days of questioning from the prosecution trying to poke holes in what she said. So there's big pros and cons for a defendant taking the stand. It can be the best way for jurors to relate to someone because if you just see someone sitting quietly for 3 months of trial, you know, you don't really know what's going through their head. You don't know their side of things. So it can really cut both ways. And we just have no real way of knowing at this point which way it'll go.
So let's take a moment and place this in context of Silicon Valley and the history of people who have brought ideas and enticed investors over the decades. And Elizabeth Holmes is one of the highest profile women in an industry that has been dominated by men. How is this trial bringing to light issues around the Silicon Valley culture and any gender dynamics that are around in the tech industry?
Yeah, so there's that famous phrase of fake it till you make it that's popular in Silicon Valley. And people have said that this trial is a bit of a test of that mantra and whether if she's convicted, that could scare other founders or shake things up. You know, some people say, oh, this is such a singular case. You know, my company isn't doing anything like that. I have nothing to worry about. So I think depending on where you're at in Silicon Valley, people will either potentially be spooked by a conviction here, or they'll say, well, I'm not doing anything, you know, near that extreme, so I'm fine. I think the fact that it's in healthcare is really pivotal. You know, companies that are making some kind of widget or a website or even a service like Uber, you know, if they're doing things that are cutting corners or not quite on the up and up, it can sometimes be shrugged off, I think, a little more than when patient health is at issue. And so I think, you know, one reason this maybe has gotten more focus from prosecutors and regulators is that it seems, you know, a little hard to be messing with patient health the way that you could, you know, maybe not live up to your promise about a website. And so I think it could, you know, it could create maybe more questions around startups in the healthcare space in particular.
So I want to get back to the fact that that Elizabeth Holmes is a woman because it was a subject of a New York Times editorial last week where Ellen Powell, who unsuccessfully filed a gender discrimination lawsuit against the venture capital firm Kleiner Perkins in 2012, wrote that, quote, it's clear that two things can be true, that Elizabeth Holmes should be held accountable for her actions as chief executive, and it can be sexist to hold her accountable for alleged serious wrongdoing and not hold an array of men accountable for reports of wrongdoing or bad judgment. What do you make of that statement that somehow Elizabeth is finding herself in the crosshairs and is being held accountable where her male counterparts have not been?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's impossible to know the motivations of prosecutors and whether gender played into this in any way. I do think it's notable, of course, that her co-defendant is a man who was running the company with her. Obviously, she was more the face of the company. You know, I think Ellen Powell really correctly points out that it's maybe less a question of whether this case should have been brought and more a question of just whether other cases are being left on the table and should be brought against men. You know, I think it's just really hard to tell motivations of the government and whether gender dynamics came into play. But, you know, it's certainly an interesting thesis that she's raised, and I know it's gotten a lot of chatter this week.
Well, and in addition to the gender issues, there's also a class issue here. We got a listener comment who wrote in that one of the themes that's not been picked up so much in this whole story here is the connections that Elizabeth Holmes' family had, and that many of her investors were through her family connections and the sort of circles that she traveled in. Do you want to comment on that aspect? Because she certainly had a powerful board, but it was through some of these family connections, was it not?
Yeah, and I think that's the case for a lot of startups that make it. You often hear, especially for women, it's very hard to get venture capital. And I think you often need a foot in the door. So I feel like her leveraging personal connections to raise her initial funding and get her first connections with the board aren't atypical in Silicon Valley. So I feel like that's, you know, that was kind of just her using every connection she had to get rolling. And I think people who don't have those connections, unfortunately, often just don't make it out of the gate.
And if she is convicted, what does that really mean for the tech industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll certainly be, you know, a big moment. I mean, you just don't see tech executives going to jail. You don't see Wall Street executives going to jail. You know, it's always a big kind of criticism after financial crises or different things is that, you know, the accountability that the public wants often doesn't happen. So, you know, whether you're for or against her, you know, seeing someone go to jail is a very serious thing that will definitely, I think, cause others in Silicon Valley to think does this reflect on what I'm doing at all? Is there anything I'm doing that was similar to this that I should not be doing? And so I'm sure it'll create a bit of soul searching if it comes to that.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us, Sarah Randazzo, legal business reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
Thanks.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to Dr. Nusha Ajami and Secretary Wade Crowfoot about how the Bay Area can become more water resilient. So stay with us.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Ethan Elkind. We want you to be a part of this next conversation. We're going to be talking about how the Bay Area can ensure its water supply stays safe and abundant as we find ourselves in the midst of yet another drought. So we want to hear from you. Have you made changes to conserve water during this latest drought? What questions do you have about reducing your water use or the measures that our cities and state can take to ensure that our reservoirs don't run dry?
Give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us a message on Twitter at State of Bay, or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org.
So it's not news to anyone that California is in the midst of another severe drought. And this dry spell, in fact, is already approaching the peak severity of the last one, which occurred from 2012 through 2015. And that was the state's driest consecutive four-year stretch since record keeping began in 1896.
In the midst of this summer's weather catastrophes, much attention has rightfully been paid to the role that global warming has played in increasing the frequency and severity of droughts in our state. But equally important is a focus on how we respond to this new normal.
So as California and the Bay Area come to terms with the possibility of longer and more severe droughts, we're confronted with a crucial question. What can we do to become more water resilient? And joining us tonight to explore that subject, we're so pleased to be joined by Dr. Nusha Ajami, Director of Urban Water Policy with Stanford University's Water in the West and a member of the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. Welcome, Nusha.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by California's Natural Resources Secretary, Wade Crowfoot. Prior to being appointed to his current position, he served as Chief Executive Officer of the nonprofit Water Foundation. And he also served under former Governor Jerry Brown. Welcome, Secretary Crowfoot.
Good to be here.
So we know we're in a drought, and when we turn on the tap, water still comes out. So for the average Bay Area resident, it may be hard to gauge how dire things are. But Nusha, just to start with you, can you give us a sense of how this current drought has impacted our water supply?
Sure. Obviously, it's becoming old news, new news, because we just, as you mentioned, Ethan, we just got out of a severe drought, and we are finding ourselves in another one yet again. And this one, actually, this year has been drier than any other year in the record as well. And we actually, a lot of our reservoirs are quite low, and we don't have, there's not much water in them left. There are some areas that have a little bit more water, more than others, but the reality is we are short in water. And it's actually another piece of this new drought we're experiencing is they're hotter too. So it's not just because we're not getting enough precipitation. Because of the heat, the snow melts faster. We get flows earlier than before. So it is quite, some of our, as I said, some of our reservoirs are quite low, and we are in a dire situation in some parts of the state.
Can you say a little bit more about that, just to give our listeners a little bit of a sense of how low our water supply is?
Yeah, I mean, it depends where you're looking at. Obviously, our precipitation has been very low. And, you know, some of our major reservoirs, for example, Oroville and Shasta, are lower than their average levels. And actually in Oroville Dam, we stopped generating electricity because the waters were so low, we can't release any more water for electricity generation. So it has a sort of double-sided effect. Not only we are low in water supply, it's also impacting our energy production. It's also, you know, it's a huge issue because of the wildfires also that you're experiencing, because of the drought. We are seeing, you know, the health of our ecosystem is sort of dwindling, and also the heat is causing some of these fires to be more difficult to manage and handle. So it's water supply is low, and also we are having some consequences of not having enough water and not getting enough precipitation with the wildfires and other other issues that we're experiencing with low energy generation as well.
So to bring you in, Secretary Crowfoot, to the conversation, it's not too comforting that we've been here before, but we've known how to deal with droughts before. So what kinds of strategies have we picked off the shelf already, and which ones might we turn to soon?
Well, you're absolutely right that we know how to navigate through drought in California. Drought and flooding are natural parts of our hydrology, meaning we have dry periods that are droughts and we have flooding. As Nusha explained, one of the changes is these warming temperatures. So when we have dry periods like the one that we're in, those heats mean that those extreme heats mean that less of our water is actually finding its way into the rivers and into our reservoirs. So we need to rely in this drought on, in part, what we've relied on in the past. The first is conservation and efficiency. You know, Californians and Americans have done really well in the last generation to become better at using energy efficiently, right? When we leave a room, we turn the light off. And Californians in the last 20 years have become much better at being efficient with their water use. And we've actually seen per capita water use decline significantly. Remarkably, particularly in Southern California, where per capita water use is very low, but also in the Bay Area. So it's conservation and efficiency. Increasingly, a lot of communities are focusing on recycling their water. In other words, using their water more than once. Other communities are focused on capturing stormwater for storage later in the year or even in future years, which is great. So those are all good examples about diversifying the supply of water that we use.
And Nusha, just to turn to you, since you serve on the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, what are you doing through the city to help encourage people to conserve water? Are there monetary incentives that are in place for water users and ratepayers?
Absolutely. So we provide water to 2.7 million Californians, and part of them are in the city of San Francisco, and the rest of it is in the peninsula. And San Francisco itself has water conservation programs that you can go to the SFPUC's website, and there are incentives and rebates for reducing indoor water use, outdoor water use. Also, BOSCA, or Bay Area Water Supply and Conservation Agency, which is sort of like an intermediary between us and the water agencies in the peninsula, has its own dedicated website that provides information on where to get rebates and incentives to reduce water use. So there are so many programs out there to help people to become more water efficient and water smart.
So we actually have a listener comment saying, I know my family needs to cut back on the water we use, but we can't afford to buy new appliances and re-landscape our yards. Or, you know, it's hard as a family to necessarily do these things. So how can someone who doesn't have the means sort of change their water usage in a meaningful way?
Actually, in San Francisco, if you reach out to our conservation program coordinators, they can help you. We have programs for low-income communities, middle-income communities. There are also, as I said, there are incentives. If you are sort of remodeling or replacing, there are incentives to replace your toilets, your washing machine, your dishwasher. But we have actually programs that applies for various people and, you know, different levels of income. So do not hesitate. I think there are so many programs out there, and I very much encourage the listeners to reach out to or go to the SFUC's website and follow.
All right, and we'll make sure to link that to our website as well. Yeah, go ahead, Ethan.
Go to the State of the Bay page on KLW for those resources. We want to be a good database there of tips for folks. But Secretary Crowfoot, I wanted to go to you. In July, Governor Newsom signed an executive order encouraging Californians to reduce water use by 15%. But many skeptics say he avoided imposing restrictions because it might have cost him some support during the recall election. So why didn't Governor Newsom make conservation mandatory this summer? And are we likely to see him do so at the end of this month, just given the severity of the water crisis right now?
Yeah, well, during this drought, much like the last drought that Governor Brown helped us navigate through, the first option or the first step is to, you know, ask folks across the state to reduce their water usage on a voluntary basis. I think we have to be really careful about issuing mandates on behavior across the state, and we want to do that as a last option. And so it's I think, a very logical step to build the awareness of the drought and let people know what's at stake and ask them to reduce their usage. We've been very clear, and the governor's been very clear, that if we get to a point of another dry winter, we don't see the rain and snow this winter, then certainly that mandatory water conservation is on the table. But, you know, we have to be, again, really careful before we mandate that, because my sense is, you know, residents step up when that sort of severe condition exists. But if it is requested or mandated too often, then we see reduced participation. During the last drought, Ethan, Californians ultimately stepped up and reduced their usage by about 24%. What's remarkable is about 16% of that water use reduction has stuck. In other words, Californians going into this drought were using about 16% less water than during the last drought. So Californians are making progress on improving conservation and efficiency. And right now, given where we're at in the drought, we're asking residents to step up once again and local water agencies to take the lead. One improvement since the last drought is that local water agencies like the SFPUC or Santa Clara Water or the East Bay MUD all have developed these drought contingency plans that really provide a customized roadmap for what they're going to do to ensure water supply reliability during the drought. And they've requested that before the state imposes statewide one-size-fits-all mandates, that they be empowered to actually implement their drought contingency plan. So that voluntary call for conservation plus our request for local water agencies to turn on those drought plans, we think is an appropriate step at this point.
And so if the state hasn't imposed mandatory restrictions, then are we likely to see cities starting to take that action?
Absolutely. We're already seeing certain parts of the state take that action. So, for example, if you live in Sonoma counties or Mendocino County, your water agency has likely imposed a mandatory restriction. If you live in Marin County, the same. We live in a remarkably diverse state. We don't have one water system. We have a system of systems. And conditions are very different in different parts across the state. So as we navigate this stage of the drought, we're really empowering local leaders, local water agencies to take those steps that are necessary. And that's what's happening.
So I want to reintroduce the program. You're listening to State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Joseph Pache with Ethan Elkind, and we're talking about ways to make the Bay Area more water resilient as we find ourselves in the midst of yet another drought. So have you made changes to conserve water during this latest drought? We want to hear about those ideas. And what questions do you have about reducing your water use or the measures that your city or county or the state can take to ensure that our reservoirs don't run dry? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org, or you can tweet us. We're at State of Bay. So, Nusha Ajami, you have written that drought can be an opportunity. So I'm very curious, what do you mean by that?
Look, there's so many different ways we can become more water efficient. And I think it's an opportunity because you can look back and see what works, what doesn't work, and how you can move forward. You know, for example, conservation and efficiency is a great example of that. We have, as a state, we have moved forward significantly. We have reduced our water use. For example, in San Francisco, our water use per capita is about, residential water use is about 43 gallon per person per day, which is quite low. But if you compare it, for example, to Denmark, which is 22 gallon per person per day, we still have some space, some, you know, way to go. You know, there are opportunities to rethink our centralized system that we have that depends on snow and rain, how we need to reconfigure that, because obviously the system is not really weathering well during this because of climate change. So how can we change the way we manage this system? What do we need to reintroduce to this system? For example, recycling, reuse, capturing stormwater. Our groundwater basins are very much depleted because of various droughts we have been experiencing. So can we recharge those groundwater basins? Is there a way we can prevent pollution, preventing our water supplies to get polluted? There are ways to think about what kind of infrastructure do we need, which size, which measure. So these are opportunities. Every one of these droughts, while it's quite stressful, it sort of brings us back to the design table and help us sort of rethink how we need to improve the system.
And how to diversify our water portfolio, exactly. As it were.
Yes.
All right, well, let's go to the phone lines. We have a caller. We have Connie dialing in. So, Connie, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you. Years ago,
Connie, we've got a lot of feedback from you. Do you mind turning down the radio so we can hear your audio better?
Now, the Chronicle had an article about the water heater being out in the garage and my shower being on the opposite end of the house. And they said there's an inexpensive way to take the pipe to the shower so you don't have to run the water before it warms up. And I thought, it's a good idea. They put in low-flow toilets. Why can't they do this?
Yeah, well, let's talk about some of these potential fixes here. Maybe Nusha, starting with you on that. Thoughts and response?
Yeah, actually, that's a very good point. We, interestingly enough, in our recent SFPUC meeting, we did discuss this recirculating pumps that can help you to warm up the water and make it warm faster, then you don't need to run the water for a long time. So there are programs right now out there. If you are interested, you can actually look into the SFPUC list that we have. One comment I make here is, I brought this up earlier too, but look, we have to look forward how we need to reconfigure our homes and communities. And I think this is a great example of that. Another one is, you know, we've used 30% of our water indoors for showering, and we actually, interestingly enough, use 30% of another 30% for flushing down, flushing toilets. And, you know, obviously your toilets and showers are often in the same location. Right now, we don't have any programs that would enable us to reuse the shower water for toilet flushing. But, you know, maybe, you know, we need to rethink that in our new buildings that we are building to sort of reimagine how we do plumbing and how we sort of reconfigure our cities and communities. You know, every new building that's built is a future infrastructure, a future community that will last for another 50 years. So it's important to realize we are building the future right now. So we have to rethink how we are doing it.
So I want to give Secretary Crowfoot a chance just to respond to Connie's comment. So, yeah, Secretary Crowfoot.
Well, listen, I totally agree with Dr. Ajami that there are a lot of technologies that we should be integrating into the homes. And already California's building code is among the world's best on energy and water efficiency, but we should do more. I'll also say that there are low-tech fixes or low-tech things to do during a drought. I remember during the last drought, my family lived in Oakland, and we put a bucket actually in the bathtub that when we're warming the water before we got in the shower, we filled up about half of a 5-gallon bucket that we then watered houseplants or went outside. Now, not everyone's going to be able to do that, but whether it's that or shorter showers or not rinsing your plates before you put them in the dishwasher, there are also low-tech ways to do your part to conserve.
So I wanted to go to a couple of emails here. So the first is from Brendan. There will be a time when we truly understand how precious water is, and maybe then we will cease to flush very small amounts of bodily waste with vast amounts of clean drinking water. All public restroom urinals should be waterless. Those that do flush should have the water turned off immediately, and public composting toilets should be mandatory and ubiquitous. So I wanted to break this up into two parts to hear your reactions. The first is, do you think people really don't get it yet? And what would it take to get them there? And then what do you think of some of these ideas? Why don't we start again with you, Nusha Ajami?
Yeah, I mean, look, we started this program saying you're in a drought and you open the faucet and water comes out, right? Majority of people really don't know where the water is coming from, where it goes. And they actually really don't think on a daily basis what it takes to bring the water to them. And when you are so disconnected from your water system, it's very easy to forget on your daily busy life how you can do better. Obviously, these droughts are reminders, but the reality is we are all having so many other things to deal with. I think Secretary Crawford mentioned this reduction in water use during the past drought. What we found in some of the research we did was the media attention to the previous drought was the biggest driver of reduction in water use during the voluntary water restriction period, which means that as people got aware of, oh my God, these reservoirs are running dry and we don't have enough water, people started reacting and responding positively and reducing their water use. So I think public awareness still around water is quite low. We don't talk enough about water. We don't think about water as much. And I think it's very important to realize this is a precious resource and we can't really use the water to water lawns outdoors or flush down toilets and all these things that we can actually rethink and restructure as we are sort of dealing with these extreme events that we are experiencing.
Yeah, I would agree. And if you think about the number of people on this planet that don't have access to fresh, safe drinking water, and the fact that we use that same water to flush our toilets, it's remarkable. So I think we do have a ways to go in terms of realizing how precious water is. You know, folks in the Bay Area should understand that, you know, they share water with endangered salmon, period. And so if you're an environmentalist that cares about the state of our fish and wildlife across the state and our biodiversity, water conservation is important. Simply put, if we utilize all the technologies and do what we know we can, there will be enough water for our environment to thrive and all of our communities to continue to thrive. But, you know, things need to change. And part of that is, you know, our evolving investments in the state and the governor and legislature investing $5 billion in modernizing our water systems, like Nusha had envisioned or talked about. But then there's a lot that we each need to be doing, and now more than ever, given the drought.
Well, we have another email question here. Someone writes in, NB writes, I use gray water from the kitchen to water the garden. I've seen that it's not necessary to use soap on every dish, only those that are greasy. I collect as much of the rinse water as possible and just let the less common soapy water go down the drain. I stop taking a shower every day and do sponge baths in between. This is better for everyone's skin, too, not to strip away natural skin oils daily. So some good beauty tips there, as well as some tips about conservation. But what do you make of these types of steps? And is there a role for public policy to support this kind of action? And again, starting with you, Nusha. And glad to hear Secretary Crowfoot weigh in as well.
Yeah, I think, look, anything you can do in your home to reduce your water use, it's valuable and important. And the ones that are actually permanently done, it's more important than the ones that are temporarily done, because you are actually changing behavior in the long run. And I think one thing I would say, Secretary Crawford mentioned about using technology or low technology solutions and high technology solutions. We have a lot of technologies out there. But the key is, if we really want to thrive in the long run and have an environment that thrives, we actually really first need to reconsider and rethink our demand before starting thinking about, okay, can I build more water or bring more water from long distances or build more technology to generate more water? We actually seriously need to consider our water use And it has to be the first step. Even when we think about investments, we actually first really need to rethink how we use water. Can we reduce this water use? And then think about, okay, what technologies are out there that can augment existing water supply and help us to thrive in the long run? And so I think that is really key when we are thinking about long-term investment in our communities. A little bit of a tangent here, but I think very important is also remember when we are investing in low-income communities or communities that don't have access to water, we are not obliged to build the same thing we have built in the past 50 or 100 years. We actually can reimagine these communities to be very different and be a lot more water efficient than what we are right now in our cities and communities. So every one of these behaviors are important, but we can also make sure we are building them into our new sort of structures that are popping up or new infrastructure that we are investing in.
And Secretary Crowfoot?
Yeah, I would just want to get a word in about, you know, outdoor landscapes. In other words, yards that some of us have. I know, for example, in San Francisco, a lot of folks live in apartments, condos, and they don't have yards. But boy, where I live in the Sacramento Valley, a lot of people have big green lawns. And, you know, in America, we've imported this aesthetic from the English Isles. They get a lot of rain all year. And there's this, I think, historic perception that a pretty yard is a verdant green yard. And in a Mediterranean climate, that is somewhat unnatural. So I just want to put in a plug for, you know, those folks who have changed their yards and have plantings that are beautiful and in some cases support pollinators like butterflies and bees, but use a lot less water. That is probably if you have a yard that's more traditional with a big lawn, that is the single most important thing that you can do, to Nusha's point, to achieve, you know, permanent water conservation is change your yard into something more natural for this climate.
So I also wanted to get back to you, Nusha Ajami, because you've mentioned a few technologies, that diversifying water portfolio that we talked about earlier, recycling water, rainwater harvesting. I've seen other things like air conditioner condensate fog catching machines like are used in Peru. And then, of course, people have also talked about desalination. We can't spend the rest, the 5 minutes we have left on the segment, going through each of these. But why don't you talk about the ones that are farthest along in development and most likely to be put into action?
Sure. Look, I think collection of all the things that you mentioned, but I think again, I would start from conservation efficiency and then start from recycling and reuse after that, because that kind of creates that circular economy we always talk about other fields. We want to make sure we can use water as many times as we can before we are discarding it. And the more we can do that, the better it is for the environment and for our cities. And I think I would say desalination, while, you know, for some communities that have done everything, can be an option. It should not be the first thing on anybody's table. It should be actually the last thing, because it's very environmentally, it has a very high environmental footprint, and also it's very costly and has a very high energy footprint. So it has a lot of different, it's very similar to our existing water supply system that we have. So it should be, again, like depending on what we do, after we have done everything, we have explored all the options, maybe as a last resort. So
just to follow up on recycling, though, what how do you think it will play, so to speak, with the public? I mean, we've obviously recycling has to take into effect, you know, hygiene and such. But I imagine there's just the idea of recycled water that just may not sit well with all people. Say more about that. Mm-hmm. And what does it take to get the recycled water to be okay? Do we put chemicals in it? You know, things like that.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, we all use recycled water. Water is basically goes around and around in a cycle, and we are using it and keep using it. So depending on where you are in the system, you're using recycled water, but basically what happens is you clean the water, put it back in the environment, goes to the downstream to another community, or actually goes through the water cycle over time, and then we use it. So recycling is a natural way that water basically regenerates. So that's the first thing. The second thing is the same actually technology that is used in desalination is used for recycling. So basically, the water that goes through the recycling system, it's as clean and as, it's drinkable water most of the time. Third thing I would say is options with recycling is you can actually tailor water to what you need to use it for. So you can recycle it to the high quality and be able to drink it. And then you can recycle it to lower quality and use it for your lawns, which hopefully you're not going to have, as Secretary Crawford said, because we don't want to have lawns anymore in California eventually. So it has this option of being able to tailor it to whatever you need to do. But technology is there. We know how to do it. And the water that comes out of these systems are quite clean and pristine, and you can drink it. And there's, you certainly do not have a scientific limitation in making that water clean and available.
Well, I wanted to ask about the infrastructure investments that all this is going to take. And Secretary Crowfoot, we know the Governor Newsom has a $5.1 billion package for water infrastructure and drought response. There's potentially a federal infrastructure bill here. What do you see as some of the key needs and the key responses from state and possibly federal governments here?
Well, I would first of all say that, you know, water agencies across the state, certainly including the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, where Dr. Ajami is on the commission, have made remarkable investments in modernizing their systems. And the water systems of California today are much more efficient and much more diversified in terms of their supply than they were even during the last drought. So we are moving in the right direction. The good news is that our policymakers in Sacramento have really prioritized building our drought resilience. And I should mention our flood resilience. And as you mentioned, $5 billion investment agreed upon this summer. And that funding will, a lot of that funding will find its way to local water agencies. And combined with the local funds, will make these investments, supply diversification, conservation and efficiency, better technologies. And then, as you mentioned, federal funding. We are likely to receive in California more federal funding than we have possibly in decades for drinking water systems, for wastewater systems, for water recycling, and so much more. So this really, while we're in yet another drought and while we're facing down the climate crisis in California, we have real alignment among the new Biden and Harris administration, the Newsom administration, legislators here, water agencies, and we will make this year and over the next coming years a generational investment in really modernizing our systems to meet the new climate reality.
So, Anusha, this is probably unfair, but in less than a minute, I'd like you to address this email from one of our listeners, Jillian. We have spent years bending over backwards to conserve water on the domestic front. I have read that residential water usage is but a drop in the bucket when compared to ag water usage or agricultural water usage. Why should it take a 30-second shower when almond growers are allowed to spill gallons and gallons to grow a few almonds?
I would just say two things. One, who is eating those almonds? We are in the city. So we are consumers of whatever comes out of agriculture. So we actually should certainly think about our eating habits and what we use in, at home. The second thing I would say is the less we waste, food waste, reducing food waste can have a huge positive environmental impact and reduce our water use in agriculture. And the last thing I would say is, the key here is the relationship between water use and land use. And that is definitely something that the state needs to look into at some point to make sure we know what we are spending, using our water for and what we are growing and making sure we don't end up in situations that we are in some of these communities that groundwater basins are sort of depleting because of some of the land use decisions we have.
Well, unfortunately, we'll have to stop it there just as we got to the cliffhanger. But hopefully we could talk to you more in the future. So I want to thank you for joining us, Dr. Anusha Ajami from Stanford's Water in the West and California Natural Resources Secretary Wade Crawfoot.
All right. And coming up after the break, we'll hear from the first female certified pickleball coach in Northern California, Patricia Strozzi. Stay with us.
This is State of the Bay. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Ethan Elkind. Pickleball is the fastest growing sport in the United States, and its popularity grew exponentially in the pandemic. I bet you didn't know that, unless you're a pickleball fan, but if you're not playing it now, you may be soon.
To understand pickleball's appeal, I recently sat down with Patricia Strazzi, the first woman certified to be a pickleball coach in Northern California. Let's take a listen. Patricia Strazzi, welcome to State of the Bay.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's great to be here, talk about one of my passions in life.
So I have to start with the obvious question. What exactly is pickleball?
Pickleball is a mix of tennis, badminton, and ping pong. Badminton because of the size of the court. It's very similar to a badminton court. Tennis because you do have all the shots that we have in tennis, you know, the volley, the ground strokes. And ping pong because the paddles are like gigantic ping pong paddles, very similar to ping pong. And some of the mechanics of the shots as well.
Mm-hmm. And then how about the ball itself?
We have a wiffle ball.
Okay.
And wow. The paddle is solid, you know, much shorter than a tennis racket, right? It's much shorter.
So pickleball, as I understand, was founded in 1965 in a backyard on Bainbridge Island in the state of Washington. So it's not so new, but relatively new. Mm-hmm. So tell us about that origin story. How did that start?
Well, they were on a rainy day, and the kids were really bored because it was raining. And they had a badminton court on their backyard, but they did not have the rackets. So they come up with the ping pong pads because they did have the ping pong pads, but not the badminton rackets there, right? And you know, they start trying different things and got the wiffle ball on it.
So it just grew out of necessity. How
exactly.
Interesting.
To entertain the kids on a rainy day, you know.
But it's interesting because you think for something that was improvised like that it wouldn't necessarily have taken off like it has. And my understanding is that the pandemic has led to an explosion of people playing pickleball. Why do you think that is?
Well, first is mostly outdoors, right? But secondly, there's no physical contact. You can actually play with your partner and still keep some distance. That helped a lot. Another thing, you know, I get newer students on a weekly basis. A lot of them, they were very active, but the gyms closed down and they didn't know what to do. They still want to be active, be healthy. And then they heard about pickleball and they heard it wasn't that difficult. So they start playing. And then usually it's a very addictive sport. So people start playing and they get hooked straight away. That happened to me and happened to a lot of people. It's addictive.
Exactly. You know, you have a history in tennis as a tennis coach,
yes.
Other racket sports, and then somehow you ended up on pickleball. And in fact, you're the first certified coach in Northern California. So what drew you to pickleball?
The way it happened was actually I saw this group of people holding a paddle and the name pickleball. So I was intrigued. I'm like, well, I've never seen that kind of paddle before. So I went to the community center, had a look, and start hitting some balls, and winning some. And I start playing, and I got it really fast because of my background in tennis. First was ping pong. I started playing ping pong when I was a little girl. I always liked it. And then tennis, and then padel. I played padel to a higher level, you know, like I represent Brazil at the Pan American and the World Championship. So then you put all this experience together. So I started playing pickleball. I was like, oh, boy, this is the whole mix, you know? So it was pretty easy for me. After a year, I was playing at the pro level.
Do you still play those other racket sports or have those left your life?
Pickleball all day.
So
I was coaching tennis, you know? Then I was coaching both tennis and pickleball for a while, you know? And eventually the higher demand of pickleball, you know, as you get older, you want a sport that's easy on your body as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm playing my first year as a senior pro this year, and it's been a great transition for me. It's working really well.
Well, in fact, I understand that pickleball was first popular among retirees, particularly in Arizona, but I understand it's moving towards a younger crowd. Do you think it's going to develop into something like a college sport? Where do you think it's going to head from here?
Well, the USAPA, they are trying really hard to make pickleball to become an Olympic sport. And we are not that far. I think pickleball needs to be in 50 countries. And right now we have pickleball in 37 countries. So it's not that far. And they're really working hard on that.
And so let's talk a little bit more about the game itself. So there's some unusual rules in pickleball, like the scoring system. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the scoring, to be honest, it's a pain in the neck. We have three scores going on: the serving team, the returning team, and whether you are server number one or number two. So let's say you have a long rally. I don't remember who just served or what was the score. It happens a lot. Pickleball, it's actually one of the biggest interference on the game. You can be playing for years, okay, and we stop the game and say, oh, what was the score? Oh, who served? It's just part of the game. I hope they eventually will change, like volleyball did too. Maybe go to up to 21 with no advantage. Because right now you can only score when you serve, right, in pickleball. And then goes up to 11. So let's just eliminate. Anyone can score. And you pay up to 21.
Well, it sounds
much easier.
It sounds like a mental challenge along with the physical challenge.
Yes. What I do is I have very easy videos on my own website. Then before I begin, it comes, I say, look, have a look at the videos, you know, just 5 minutes, you know, before I come to the court so they can be more familiar with the score and the rules and everything. Yeah.
Right, right. So where are there pickleball courts in the Bay Area in case someone wants to go just watch people play?
Well, we have the biggest courts are in Concord, the East Bay. In Concord, okay. At Willow Pass, we have 14 courts. The biggest tournament in the Northern California is there. Then you have Walnut Creek Pickleball Club at Rudgear Park. We have 8 courts there. Those are the two bigger places in the area. You know? Then you have a few clubs. Some of them are getting fully dedicated courts, at least 4, or painted lines on the tennis courts, you know.
I see. And there's a concentration of pickleball courts right up the road from our studios at McLaren Park here in San Francisco. So what should someone who's interested in learning pickleball do? What should be their first step?
Well, first find out where the courts are, right? Mm-hmm. So you can go to the usapickleball.com and they have there all the courts you could possibly find throughout the U.S. And look for the ambassadors, because the ambassadors, they teach you as a volunteer, how to play the game. But then if you get really serious about it, then you should get a coach to start from the beginning, have that great foundation so you can always improve your game, if you are serious about it, right? Which people usually get serious about. Even on a recreational level, it can be very competitive.
Wonderful, wonderful. It never ceases to amaze me what captures people's imagination and energy and focus. Patricia Strazzi, thank you so much for joining me this evening.
No, you are welcome. It was my pleasure. Thank you, Joseph.
Ready? Okay. Hit one over the net. Give that ball a good whack.
So that was my interview with Patricia Strazzi about the newfound popularity of pickleball.
And that's State of the Bay this week. To learn more about any of the topics we covered tonight, visit the State of the Bay page at KALW.org.
We want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation.
For a link to this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org.
Our engineer this evening was Dee Miner, and tonight's show was produced by Chris Snooney and Wendy Holcomb.
Good night, and thanks so much for listening.
Have a great week.